Well, now, given that it's the first Saturday of the month, time for the Saturday Extra Water Cooler conversation. And today, as our peak bushfire season approaches, and of course with all this week's and this weekend's natural disasters in our region uppermost in our minds, the inevitable questioning has begun. What can we learn and how can we be prepared? But look, I have another question. Why is it that sometimes nature will never prepare us? And it will deny us that early warning for the random terror raining down. Shortly, two guests with great insights into how Australians remember and, yes, forget bushfires. First, though, time to go back and to remember through the ABC archive.
Yesterday we got belted. As you know, we lost lives. We've lost numerous properties.
At one point, it all went black. We could see fire closing in on all four sides.
There are still 31 fires burning across Victoria. Some 350,000 hectares of land has been destroyed.
Literally fireballs and tornadoes just coming through. The whole place just went black.
The wind pressure actually blew my front windows in and I was showered with sparks.
Everywhere you go, you see the remains of what may have been friends and family's homes. The locals themselves have had to make a decision, do I stay or do I go?
Everything was on fire. We had to drive through fire to get out, but we weren't going to leave the kids there. How are we going to keep two babies afloat in a dam? Treading water, it was a split-second decision.
Stark reminders there of the power and the fury of our bushfires. Well, around our water cooler today, Tom Griffiths, the history professor at the Australian National University in Canberra, and his essay, We Have Still Not Lived Long Enough, was the winner of this year's Alfred Deakin Prize in the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards. And also along with us, Ian Manock, who's lecturer in emergency services at Charles Sturt University. He knows very well firsthand the power and unpredictability of nature. He's been a marine police officer in typhoon-prone Hong Kong and a district emergency services manager in Tasmania. So welcome, gentlemen, to you both.
Good morning.
Tom, with the earthquakes in the Sumatra and that terrible warning about the calamity coming to the Philippines, strong word, isn't it, and the tsunami in Samoa, I've continually heard discussions about the need and effectiveness of early warnings this week. However, when I read your essay concentrating on the bushfires early this year, you put forward this idea that despite technological advances and despite warnings, really nothing can be done about what I'll term extraordinary acts of God. Why did you lay your stress there?
Well, I think a sensible fatalism is not a bad attitude towards the awesome power of nature from time to time. And it's something that we resist. We really feel this deep human instinct to control it, to tame it. And I think sometimes that diverts us into discussions that about politics of blame, of trying to find a human cause. This often distracts us and helps us forget just how powerful nature can be. And I'm very impressed by fire managers who say to me, you know, sometimes just something roars out of the Australian bush that we just cannot stop.
Mm. Of course, this is what's so thought-provoking about it, because Paul Toohey's written very interestingly in The Australian this morning about people whom he's seeing in Samoa and Indonesia, and he's saying that they actually have an incredible fatalism, which I think, anyway, this is what's made me question it, Australians might say, ah, yes, well, of course, that's what happens when you're not fully developed, that you have to have that when you've got no means of dealing with it, and that a mark of a developed society is that you don't actually leave nature to itself.
Well, of course, we're talking about this year and the Royal Commission and so forth about how we can improve warning systems. And of course, I'm right behind that kind of discussion. However, I think we also do need to accept that that sometimes we cannot control nature, and that that kind of fatalism will allow us to accept the recurrence, the recurrent power of these events. Mm-hmm. And if we feel that we can control nature and tame it and force our will upon it, then we won't be rebuilding with a sense that this kind of event will happen again.
Just before I come to Ian Manick, however, I wonder if that's true, Tom, because your essay told me something I hadn't forgotten. In fact, I had no idea of it. To quote, Victorians live entirely within what the international fire historian Stephen Pine calls the fire flume. It is the most distinctive fire region of Australia and the most dangerous in the world. Now, I didn't know that.
Yes, it's a distinctively deadly region, and so I'm also calling, I think, for some ecologically specific responses to fire. So there are all types of fires and many types of forests, but Victoria is the most deadly fire region on the planet. When those high-pressure systems stall in the Tasman and those hot northerlies sweep down across a topography of dense vegetation and steep slopes, and the temperatures rise and the humidity plummets and the southerly change sweeps in, yes, we've got a really a furious and fierce chemistry that we have to respect.
Ian Manick, you lived in Hong Kong as a marine police officer, and you had great experience of the equivalent of our bushfire season, the typhoon season. Have Hong Kong residents lived long enough, just taking up Tom's point, do their collective memories work well enough so that they actually do respect this season? Is it different to here?
It's slightly different in the way that here in Australia we choose to live in bushfire prone areas. In Hong Kong, they don't choose to live as such in typhoon prone areas because the whole region is typhoon prone. And also, it occurs every year. Everyone is susceptible to it, and everyone faces
it's
it.
Very democratic.
Exactly, yeah. Here in Australia, we choose to live in the city where we don't have bush as such, or the urban areas, or the rural areas, or the interface areas. So there's a little bit of a difference. But yeah, I think the combined history, though, over the years in Hong Kong, the Chinese have experienced, and the Japanese, and that whole South China area, South China Sea area, has experienced typhoons for thousands and thousands of years, and it's passed along the history of it. Whereas in Australia, we're very new. We're new kids on the block. We've been here for just over 200 years as white settlers. I think we've got a lot to learn from the Aboriginal stories and the heritage and the history that goes on, and it's just trying to pick that to find out just how much has happened in the past.
So would you call it a sensible fatalism that you met up there?
I like that. It was, I suppose it was. It was going to happen. It was inevitable. And they did what they could to reduce the impact when it was going to occur and embraced it when it did. It was often a very good excuse for not having to go to work and for having parties and all those sorts of things that you do when you're young and there's something new and novel that comes out of the air.
So the whole discussion around early warning systems and the sort of survival arsenal, is it different up there? Have you watched on with interest the way it's unfolding in Australia?
I think it's a bit different in the fact that you've got two different types of events. You've got an event that is climatic and very easy to track, and you know it's coming for quite a while. With a bushfire event, they can happen just overnight. So the warnings that come through, I like the way that Tom thinks and is written in the fact that sometimes nature just does throw things at us that are far beyond our abilities, and we'll never be able to stop the bushfires unless we cut down all the trees and paint everything green concrete. But until then, and we don't choose to do that, we choose to live in the trees, we choose to be with nature, and when it's not bushfires occurring or bushfire season, it's beautiful. And that area of Victoria that was burnt was stunning, and it will come back as bushfire prone areas and bushfire affected areas do. We only have to look at our own Blue Mountains to see what's happened after the big 1994 fires.
See, Tom, you do that great phrase you've got in your essay, that is, we never seem to learn from history. We have this great need for a knowledge of history. That is, that nature can overwhelm culture. Now, if we really took that in, Tom, would we be rebuilding in Victoria? Just a question.
Yes. Well, yes, because as Ian says, you know, these are beautiful regions that we love to live in. And I fully support those communities and greatly admire those communities who right now are conducting this extraordinary experiment by rebuilding in what can, from time to time, be a very dangerous area. So we've got to help them think through what that means. And one of the suggestions that I made in that essay and have been speaking a bit about is to remember that if you wish to stay and defend, and most of us will want to do that, even if it's a very dangerous option. We want to have a last resort, and that last resort could be sensible fire refuges, dugouts, bunkers on properties. And in 1939, when that great fire, Black Friday, swept through those Victorian forests, dozens of lives were saved in dugouts. People in little sawmill settlements climbed into these wombat holes in the ground with corrugated iron over the top of them and hessian bags at the door kept wet with water from the inside, and they survived. It was horrible, it was traumatic, but they got through as the fire front went over them. And we seem to have forgotten that too, that, you know, there are culturally specific and distinct ways of surviving Holocaust fire in those forests.
Yeah, it is interesting this, though, whether there is an early, identifiable early, as you say, in this fire region, this most dangerous fire region in the world, on the really fatal days, because that whole business about leaving early or staying and defending your home, in a way it was a death sentence, as you say, in the mountain communities. Are you saying that the whole discussion around early warnings is a little awry?
No, I think we can improve our warning systems, and I think they're already being improved this summer, and we must.
Did you see that ad that's on now that has started, the community service ads I noticed on television last night, with the whole much more sophisticated grading system, I noticed?
Exactly, yes. So this is a good step forward. This is us learning to live in this environment and being more discriminating about climate and bushfire. Yes, I think we have to accept that there will also, when however discriminating our warning systems, there will be very difficult to identify what exactly is early in the fire plume. There are, I imagine, you know, people waking that Black Saturday morning and thinking, well, it's going to be a hot, horrible day. I'm going to listen out for those warnings of fire and fire coming in my direction. But for the moment, I'm safest in my own home. And that's a reasonable way for them to have felt. So exactly when was early in that area? Should they have evacuated the previous day? How do we help them make these decisions?
Well, indeed, you say there's a sort of a libertarian feel in the way we have dealt with early warnings generally, although maybe that's in flux now. Ian, what's it like in Hong Kong? Is it inclined to be more authoritarian, or again, is there a fatalism about everybody just knowing what? And do they also know there'll be people who die? See, this is one of the things I just wonder whether we're grappling with in Australia.
Yeah, they do, and very few do die because the warning systems that are put in place within the tropical areas regarding typhoons and cyclones, etc., are very well tested and have been around for a long, long time. So they get a lot of notice. And in Hong Kong, they have a series of warnings which go from a very early warning, they call it Typhoon Warning 1, and it goes through a series of warnings telling you which way the wind's coming from, which way it will go.
So people are quite educated about it.
So they're educated about it. It's on the television. It's put up on all TV stations in the corner of the TV. There's a little sign that comes up, and each sign is a different warning level. So people are aware of that and take appropriate action. It is quite well done. And I think we're starting to do that here in Australia, and it's just getting sensible about it because these major events are happening more frequently and are having more impact on our populations because we choose to live in these disaster-prone areas.
That's exactly what Mary Robinson was talking about earlier in the program. Look, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Thank you very much.
And Tom Griffith's essay, which is really something, called We Have Still Not Lived Long Enough. It was published online on Swinburne University's Inside Story, and there's a link on our website. He's also the author of Forests of Ash, an Environmental History, published by Cambridge University Press. And Ian Manock is lecturer in emergency services at Charles Sturt University. And, well, I'd love to hear from you about that. As I say, I think this is very much a work in progress, as it were, for the Australian people.